He was responsible for leaking that U.S. briefing paper for diplomats prior to the climate summit in Warsaw. We're also joined by Martin Kaur, executive director of the South Center based in Geneva. He's a journalist and the former director of the Third World Network in Malaysia. Welcoming you both to Democracy Now! It's good to have you back, Nitin. Can you respond to what Todd Stern says, that to talk about this cable where they referred to loss and damage as blame and liability was to mischaracterize it?
I think he's in what diplomatic language is called saying the untruth, if not a lie, on what he's stating. It's pretty obvious for them that they're very clear since last 5 years that they'll fight this idea of anything concerning liability or damage sweeping into the climate change talks. How they would do is being revealed here. How they would undo this process where poor countries can ask for reparation money, how they would strategize gets revealed through this cable. How they would put out a public spin, even while they do this, to dismantle the loss and damage argument within climate change is also revealed in the cable. I think that's the only embarrassment about them. There's nothing new. We know that the U.S. is here to draw down the talks to the least common denominator.
I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Martin Kaur is the executive director of the South Center based in Geneva, journalist and former director of the Third World Network in Malaysia. And thank you so much to Nitin Sethi, senior assistant editor at The Hindu, responsible for leaking the U.S. cable on the climate negotiations before the summit began here in Warsaw. We'll link to it at democracynow.org.
Hey, Tom Hartman here, and KBOO, Community Radio for Portland and Beyond, is bringing me to Portland. I hope to see you Friday, November 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at Powell's on Burnside in Portland. My new book is out, The Crash of 2016, and I'll be giving a talk and signing books at Powell's, so be there or be square.
The time is now 5:02. Next up, the KBOO Evening News, which has been made possible in part by the KBOO Foundation members and a grant from
the Clinton Street Theater,
featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a live report from a teacher's rally on the Burnside Bridge that began at 4:30 and is continuing until 5:30.
We'll also hear about the top 90 polluters worldwide and how they are responsible for two-thirds of the world's climate change.
And an update on the Portland police negotiations with the city for a new contract and how they're working to get out of a requirement that they be tested for steroid use.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 22nd, 2013. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Liam Delta. A meeting will be held this Sunday in the town of North Bend on the Oregon coast in an ongoing process to approve or deny a proposed liquid natural gas pipeline and terminal that would be built in Coos Bay. Senator Wyden will be present at the meeting. It begins at 1 p.m. at Southwest Oregon Community College in North Bend. KBOO reporter Keegan Heron spoke with Jody McCaffrey. She's organizing Citizens Against LNG to speak at the upcoming meeting concerning safety and environmental issues that the terminal would pose.
My name is Jody McCaffrey. I am the volunteer executive director of the Citizens Against LNG. We are just a grassroots group of citizens that formed in 2006 when the Jordan Cove proposal first had scoping meetings with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
And what company is proposing the pipeline and terminal?
Veresen owns between 75 and 95% of the Jordan Cove Energy Project. They're an energy development company out of Canada. There is a small part of that Jordan Cove Energy Project that is controlled by Energy Products Development, LLC, and they were the original company that came here that introduced Jordan Cove to our area.
So how will the meeting on Sunday affect the decision process for whether the terminal gets built?
Senator Wyden actually is the chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, and that gives him a little more say and authority over other congressmen on this issue. And, you know, he has some influence there. The Department of Energy does have criteria on how they will be deciding this, but politics being what they are, we know that can influence that decision some. We hope that it is done above board and, you know, correct. The Department of Energy makes decisions on whether projects should move forward based on the commodity. If exporting liquefied natural gas is in the best interest of the United States as a whole. Right now, they're going down a list of applicants as they have applied to FERC to get their environmental reviews approved. Cameron LNG is the next one, and then after that is Jordan Cove. So it's very close to them making a decision on Jordan Cove. So that's why it's kind of a critical time, and Jordan Cove has hired lobby firms out of Washington, D.C. They've come into our area. They're blasting on the radio every 5 to 20 minutes, you know, how great Jordan Cove is. They've done all kinds of marketing, and they're planning to attend this meeting en masse. And so we have got to attend en masse, too, to show them that the local people don't want this project. We have lots of reasons why we don't want it. It's not in the best interest of our area or the country as a whole.
And do they have estimates as to like when the terminal would be completed?
It's hard to get correct information from Jordan Cove, and FERC, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, has not actually issued a timeline yet. They are actually looking to produce the draft environmental impact statement. I don't know when that will be out. They've had their scoping meetings already. We assume it'll be out after the first of the year sometime, but we don't know exactly when. And when that comes out, they usually issue a timeline that shows when things will happen. And we don't have that exactly at this point.
I've been speaking with Jody McCaffrey of Citizens United Against LNG. This is Keegan Heron with 90.7 FM KBOO.
More information can be found at citizensagainstlng.com.
Oil refinery equipment being moved from Portland to the tar sands oil operation in Alberta, Canada, has stirred a new frenzy of controversy. The shipment of a water purification vessel totaling 380 feet in length is too large for transport by freeway due to the low clearance of overpasses. An alternate route was proposed, but it includes passages through Nez Perce tribal lands and a federally protected river corridor. Also, the height of utility poles and transmission lines along the route will be problematic. On Sunday, the Oregon Trail Electric Cooperative, or the OTEC, and the Omega Morgan Company, the transport company contracted to make the delivery, determined that no special work is necessary. Officials at Omega Morgan have requested the OTC workers accompany the shipment to ensure safe clearances. So far, their request has not been accommodated. However, utility workers may be present at specific locations along the journey, says Jim Horan, the spokesman for the OTEC. A transport permit has not yet been finalized for the movement through eastern Oregon. That was scheduled to begin on Sunday. A spokesman for the Oregon DOT says approval of the permit for the so-called megaload shipment could be granted as soon as this afternoon.
High levels of arsenic have recently been discovered in the North Lake shipyard near Seattle. The Washington State Department of Energy reports that sandblasting performed by the property's previous owner generated the contamination. In 1994, the property transferred ownership. North Lake Shipyard was required at this time to establish a trust fund for future cleanup of the site. Work crews will now use the $1.5 billion currently in the fund to begin dredging to remove contaminated mud from nearby Lake Union. The cleanup will begin in December and will be monitored by the Department of Ecology. The 8,000 cubic yards of waste that is expected to be removed will be transferred to a solid waste disposal facility. The process is predicted to take 6 months to complete. After the cleanup is finished, the area will be covered with many inches of clean sand.
A clause in the proposed Portland police contract would loosen the current regulations on steroid abuse among officers. The city of Portland began random testing last year for officers that would result in automatic termination if steroids were present. In meetings with the union, a tentative agreement has been made that would allow officers a chance to prove that the steroids were actually from unlabeled sports supplements. In light of this, other cities have simply posted lists of supplements that are safe to consume. Though the city of Portland claims this is not realistic due to the frequent new products on the market. Sports supplements are not tested by the FDA, thus some police bureaus outright ban the use of them due to their unhealthy nature. Union ballots will be counted on Tuesday, and the contract will then go into the city for approval. In more recent news, the Portland Police Bureau mistakenly allowed five officers to carry beanbag shotguns that never went through the proper training. Among those officers is Dane Reister, who was fired last month over the shooting of William Kyle Monroe in 2011. Reister was never given the go-ahead to carry the firearm, with which he permanently disabled Monroe, although he had been using the beanbag gun for 9 years prior to the incident. Though numerous training exercises and on-street encounters, Reister used the gun and was never verified by anyone in the Bureau that he was authorized to carry it.
Portland public school teachers are currently occupying the Burnside Bridge in a protest against poor working conditions and low pay. Today's protest by teachers follows a walkout earlier today by students at Roosevelt High School in support of their teachers. Negotiations broke down this week between the teachers' union and the Portland Public School Administration. Following the impasse, the teachers' union announced that they may strike as early as January. That would be the first walkout in the school district's history. Teachers have been negotiating for higher wages, better health insurance, and a contractual limitation on workload. The district is trying to overturn a limitation which keeps the number of students for each teacher to 180. Any more than that, and the teachers' union says the education of the students will suffer. The earliest date for a strike would likely be January 6th, the day students return from winter break. We go now to KBOO's Keegan Herron. He's live on the scene. Keegan, can you describe what's happening on the Burnside Bridge right now?
Yes, there are thousands of people lining both sides of the street. Lots of signs, lots of chants. 2, 4, 6, 8, let the teachers educate. But despite the chilliness, there are lots and lots of people out here, lots of cars honking, showing support for these teachers with their protests. I'm here with Gwen with the PAT. And so, Gwen, what brought you out here today?
Our teachers wanted to send a strong message to the district that it's important to negotiate a fair contract, and all the parents and community decided to come out and show their support as well.
What are some of the issues that teachers in Portland Public Schools are facing right now? What brought them to this point?
I would say there are many issues, but the most important issue for our folks, it's called workload. And what that means to a teacher is their ability to meet their students' needs. That means class size matters. It means caseload, student load makes a difference in a child's life and in their education. So that's what we want to talk about, and the district refuses to talk about it.
And what are some steps forward from here? What will happen next, in your opinion?
Well, we're hoping that this sends a strong message to them that there's a lot of people that are supporting teachers and that they really need to get back to the bargaining table and send the decision makers to the bargaining table to figure out how we can best meet the needs of kids and honor teachers in the process. So hopefully this will send them back to doing some real negotiating and not pretend anymore.
I'm Keegan Heron with KBOO FM. Thank you, Gwen. Thank you for all the teachers out there who spend their time and energy teaching our kids. That's all, Liam.
Thank you. That was Keegan Heron reporting live from the Burnside Bridge.
This week, Portland Mayor Charlie Hales fired Jack Graham, the chief administrator of the Office of Management and Finance, or OMF. In a statement, the mayor said that the problems surrounding the office were too distracting and that it was time to make a change. The problems around Jack Graham began in the spring of 2012 when he tried to conceal $200,000 of OMF money by putting it into the Water and Sewer Reserve Fund to keep it from getting cut from the budget. The transfer was stopped after whistleblowers intervened to point out the violation in city policy. Before June of this year, the information had been under wraps until after the city launched an internal investigation. The investigation found that Graham was planning to say oops, quote, oops, if confronted by about the shift of money. Jack Graham's last day in office is set for January 13th. Graham will receive 1 year severance pay because he was dismissed without cause. This amounts to nearly $200,000 in city money.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, Christy Krug, a local author, speaks about creative breakthroughs and overcoming obstacles in writing and art. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. This weekend's weather will be sunny with highs of 50 degrees and lows in the 30s. The moon is a waning gibbous. At least one warming shelter will be open tonight for people who have no other place to get out of the cold. That shelter is located at 1302 Southeast Ankeny Street, and pets are allowed. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 31 counts per minute in North Portland. In Beaverton, it's 30 counts per minute with a high of 48. Damascus, Oregon has a count of 31 CPM, high 46. Powell Butte measures 26 CPM with a high of 46. Seattle, Washington has 30 counts per minute, high of 39. And Sitka, Alaskan has a radiation count of 33 counts per minute with spikes up to 49. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
It is now 5:19 p.m., time for the daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Election days can be as dizzying as a three-ring circus with all three acts going at once. In the center ring of this month's balloting circus was the New York City mayoral race, which spotlighted the dazzling high-wire performance of Bill de Blasio. This progressive populist was practically unknown at the start, but his grassroots campaign, innovative policies, and loose style captivated voters and shocked the city's establishment with a landslide victory. Then came the lion tamers of Coralville, Iowa. Oddly, the beastly Koch brothers got involved in this small town's elections, roaring in with money and right-wing swagger. Americans for Prosperity, the chief political arm of the multibillionaire extremists, ran a high-dollar campaign to defeat Coralville's mayor and two city council members. But the people rose up on Election Day and kicked the Koch boys' keisters. Voters sent the rich out-of-towners scampering away, voting overwhelmingly to return all three incumbents to office. Next was a very strange clown act that took place in, where else, Texas, where a right-wing white Republican won a seat on the Houston Community College Board of Trustees. Curiously, he won in a district that's predominantly African-American. How did Dave Wilson do that? By pretending to be black. In his flyers, which had no photos of him but plenty of smiling African-American faces he took from the Internet, Dave claimed to be endorsed by Ron Wilson, a popular black political leader. Actually, though, it was not the black Ron Wilson from Houston who had endorsed the white Republican. Rather, it was Dave's own cousin Ron, who's also white and lives in Iowa. This is Jim Hightower saying, after he won, Dave was unapologetic about his fakery, vacuously asserting that all politicians are out there deceiving voters. What a clown.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
A study published this week uses a unique approach to tracking emissions in the atmosphere from fossil fuels back to their sources. Researchers learned just 90 entities produce two-thirds of the world's greenhouse gases. Richard Heaty, founder of the Climate Accountability Institute and author of the report, spoke with KBOO's Robin Ryan about what role the study's findings will play in shaping policy.
How can greenhouse gas emissions be tracked back to the source?
What we did is to use mostly self-reported data in terms of annual reports issued by the investor-owned companies. Some of these go back to the early 1900s. The SEC passed an act in 1934 requiring all shareholder companies to issue annual reports. So we've been able to find these reports in libraries around the world. Not always easy. We had to go to several libraries abroad in London and Sydney and Johannesburg and also in Cambridge and Berkeley and Boulder to find uncatalogued, dusty copies of very old annual reports. So we used statements of annual production of oil and gas, natural gas, and coal for every entity that we've covered. As I said, there are about 50 investor-owned companies. And then we carefully tabulate how much of each fuel. We try to track how much carbon there is in coal, for example, which varies by heating value. We're carefully tracking the carbon so that we can estimate how much ends up in the atmosphere when it's burned by the eventual users. But we also have to deduct, since we're interested really in what ends up being emitted to the atmosphere, the non-energy uses of petroleum in particular, for petrochemicals, for asphalt, road oil used in asphalt, for wax and lubricants, and deduct that from the total. So we're only looking at carefully estimating the carbon that ends up in the atmosphere and tracked back to each entity and how much fossil fuel they have used year by year.
What role do you see this study playing in the dialogue about accountability for disrupting the quality of the planet's climate going forward?
Well, I think it will be debated by shareholders and large investors, and mutual fund managers. Some boards of directors might pick up the topic about how this might impact their future business plans. Most of these companies have very large reserves of recoverable oil, gas, and coal, and that in aggregate exceed what the planet's atmosphere can absorb if we want to avoid the 2 degrees centigrade warming that scientists agree we should stay below.
Of what you learned through the research to create this report, what would you say surprised you the most?
We've all focused on ExxonMobil as the largest and most profitable oil company the world has ever seen. And I did a forerunner study in 2004 that looked just at the history of ExxonMobil from its Standard Oil days. So I thought that would be the largest company, but through the mergers and acquisitions that today's Chevron has gone through over the past several decades, acquiring or merging with Getty Oil and Gulf Oil and Skelly and other entities, Texaco merged with Chevron, for example, in 2002 or so. So they emerged as a top investor-owned company.
Your report's conclusions suggest further studies are going to be conducted examining the ethical factors in play as it pertains to accountability and climate change. When do you expect that to be wrapped up and publicly available?
Those investigations, I think we will collaborate with philosophers and ethicists. I'll be writing a paper over the next year that looks at the nature of responsibility and where it might appropriately lie between us as consumers. We're, of course, all partially responsible, and what share is meaningfully attributed to the producers themselves.
For KBU News, this is Robin Ryan.
This past week, the United Nations talks on climate change were on the verge of breaking down. The talks, being held in Warsaw, Poland, have been marked by walkouts, demonstrations, and recriminations. Disputes erupted over whether or not rich countries should pay compensation to the poor for the effects of climate change, and how governments can move to a historic global deal on cutting greenhouse gas emissions. Progress is being made on a compromise proposal to channel funds to vulnerable countries when they suffer major climate disasters, like the recent typhoons in the Philippines. But a comprehensive deal on emission cuts being sought by the European Union and the U.S. remains elusive. A group of developing countries launched a furious attack on the European Union over plans to set out a timetable towards cutting greenhouse gas emissions. The countries, including China, India, and Saudi Arabia, either because they have a large fossil fuel interest or because they need cheap oil to continue to grow industry.
President Obama and his colleagues have previously expressed concern regarding the rights of a minority in the Senate, particularly during the term of George W. Bush. Democratic Senator Harry Reid contradicted this stance yesterday when the Senate, in an historical move, passed legislation to change the operation of Congress. The initiative to reduce the number of votes required to prevent a filibuster from 60 to 51 prevents Republican filibusters from blocking executive and judicial nominees made by President Obama. Officially, the changes affect presidential nominations to the judicial and executive branch only.
Last September, Russia detained a Greenpeace vessel as well as 30 protesters following an Arctic drilling protest. The protest was staged at a fixed gas platform on Russian territory. Arrests were made under the claim that the activists were in violation of Russian laws of piracy. These charges were later reduced to breach of hooliganism laws. Today, the UN Maritime Tribunal ordered Russia to relinquish their hold on both the Netherlands-based ship and the detainees of varying international descent. Dutch authorities oppose Russia's decisions, claiming the country has violated policies of international freedom of navigation. Russia made a statement following the ruling that the Maritime Tribunal based in German city of Hamburg has no jurisdiction in the case. Greenpeace will appeal the detention of an Australian activist next week in Russia. There is still no official ruling on the next steps to free the Greenpeace vessel or the other detainees.
According to Pakistani officials, three missiles from U.S. drones hit a madrasa or Islamic seminary, killing six people, including two teachers. A teacher at the seminary said there were nearly 100 students present when the attack occurred, including 16 students in the room next to the one that was targeted. They survived. A U.S. official disputed that the attack was aimed at a madrasa. The official, who spoke on the condition of anonymity, acknowledged that a madrasa was in the vicinity but said it was not damaged. Instead, the official said, the target was a compound associated with the Haqqani network, which is accused of multiple attacks against American forces in Afghanistan. Haqqani is wanted by the United States for a 2008 attack on a Kabul hotel that killed six people, including one American, according to the FBI. By some reports, the second-in-command of the Haqqani network was killed in the attack. But Pakistani officials said Haqqani was not at the compound during the attack. A spokesman for Pakistan's Movement for Justice Party, which is headed by the popular politician and former cricket star Imran Khan, said the latest attack was a declaration of war against the people of Pakistan. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif also issued a statement yesterday condemning drone strikes, calling them a violation of Pakistan's sovereignty. There's now widespread fear in Pakistan that no part of the country is safe because drones are firing missiles outside the tribal areas.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Logan Unterberg, Genevieve McDaniel, Carl Vischer, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Keegan Heron. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. Local numbers for Senator Ron Wyden, the number is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. Again, you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With award-winning journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's More Talk Radio, the show with a compassionate point of view, with Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott.